Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 3, Text 2. Krishna is the source of all incarnations. Yashyambasi Shayanasya. Yoganidram Vitanvata. Nabhi Vidam Bujara Seed. For Ma Vishva Shujampati. Yashyambasi Shayanasya. Yoganidram Vitanvata. Nabhi Vridam Bujara Seed. Brahma Vishva Shijampati. Yashyambasi Shayanasya. Yoganidram Vitanvata. Nabhi Vridam Bujara Seed. Brahma Vishva Shujampati.
Yashambasi Sayanasya.
Yashambasi Sayanasya.
Yoga Nidram Vitanvata.
Yoga Nidram Vitanvata.
Nabi Nidam Bujadasi.
Nabi Nidam Bujadasi.
Brahma Vishva Shujampati.
Brahma Vishva Shujampati.
Yashya,
whose?
Ambasi,
in the water.
Shayanasya,
lying down.
Yoga Nidram,
sleeping in meditation.
Vitanvata, ministering. Nabhi, navel. Krida, out of the lake. Ambujat, from the lotus. Asit, was manifested. Brahma, the grandfather of the living beings. Vishva, the universe. Sujam, the engineers. Pati, master. Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. A part of the Purusha lies down within the water of the universe. From the navel lake of his body sprouts a lotus stem. And from the lotus flower atop this stem, Brahma, the master of all engineers in the universe, becomes manifest. Purport. The first Purusha is the Karnadakshaya Vishnu. From his skin holes, innumerable universes have sprung up. In each and every universe, the Purusha enters as the Garbhadakshayi Vishnu. He is lying. He is lying within the universe, which is full with the water of his body. And from the navel of Garbhadakshayi Vishnu has sprung the stem of the lotus flower, the birthplace of Brahma, who is the father of all living beings and the master of all the demigod engineers engaged in the perfect design and working of the universal order. Within the stem of the lotus, there are 14 divisions of planetary systems, and the earthly planets are situated in the middle. Upwards there are other, better planetary systems, and the topmost system is called Brahmaloka or Satyaloka. Downwards from the earthly planetary systems, there are seven lower planetary systems inhabited by the Asuras and similar other materialistic living beings. From Garbhadakshay Vishnu, there's an expansion of the Shiradakshay Vishnu, who is the collective Paramatma of all living beings. He is called Hari, and from him all incarnations within the universe are expanded. Therefore, the conclusion is that the Purusha avatar is manifested in three features. First, the Karnadakshayi, who creates the aggregate material ingredients in the Mahatattva. Second, the Garbhadakshayi, who enters into each and every universe. And third, the Shiradakshayi Vishnu, who is the Paramatma of every material object, organic or inorganic. One who knows these plenary features of the personality of Godhead knows Godhead properly. And thus the knower becomes freed from the material conditions of birth, death, old age, and disease, as is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. In this shloka, the subject matter of Mahavishnu is summarized. The Mahavishnu lies down in some part of the spiritual sky by his own free will. Thus he lies in the ocean of Karana, from where he glances over material nature, and the Mahatattva is at once created. Thus electrified by the power of the Lord, the material nature at once creates innumerable universes, just as in due course a tree decorates itself with innumerable grown fruits. The seed of the tree is sown by the cultivator, and the tree or creeper in due course becomes manifested with so many fruits. Nothing can take place without a cause. The Karana ocean is therefore called the causal ocean. Karana means causal. We should not foolishly accept the atheistic theory of creation. The description of the atheist is given in the Bhagavad Gita. The atheist does not believe in the creator, but he cannot give a good theory to explain the creation. Material nature has no power to create without the power of the Purusha, just as a Prakriti, or woman, cannot produce a child without the connection of a Purusha, or man. The Purusha impregnates and the Prakriti delivers. We should not expect milk from the fleshy bags of the neck of a goat, though they look like breastly nipples. Similarly, we should not expect any creative power from the material ingredients. We must believe in the power of the Purusha. I like that, power of the Purusha. Who impregnates Prakriti or nature. Because the Lord wished to lie down in meditation, the material energy created innumerable universes at once. And each of them the Lord lay down, and thus all the planets and the different paraphernalia were created at once by the will of the Lord. The Lord has unlimited potencies, and thus he can act as he likes by perfect planning, although personally he has nothing to do. No one is greater than or equal to him. That is the verdict of the Vedas. Om Gyan Pumaranda Shaganan Jana Salakaya Shaksumi Kamina Kasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So, the third question by the sages was to describe the incarnations.
Yes, sir.
So this chapter is begun that description, for that discussion. So Sutta is beginning the description of the incarnations, and first he starts with the explanation of the Purusha incarnations. And this is very fitting, because this is the beginning. Krishna's creative force, the force of creation of all the material universes, is here. So we have the first three Vishnu expansions being listed first. And, of course, this the purports today and yesterday, Prabhupada has given excellent discussion of these three Purushas, exactly what their function is, how they manifest. The other thing that's important about first covering the Purusha incarnations is that it's mentioned here, And it's further elaborated a couple of verses later in verse 5 that the Shiradakshai Vishnu, the third Vishnu expansion, is the source of all subsequent incarnations. In other words, the Leela avatars and all the other incarnations come from Shiradakshai Vishnu. That's described here in the purport and in verse 5. So these are obviously very, very important expansions of Krishna, very important incarnations that we need to understand. We had a nice class yesterday where it's described by Madhumati that this is important for us to know. And she gave the example, she said, if somebody loves someone, then you want to know everything about them. So since we obviously, I hope, we all have some love for Krishna, for Radha Shyama Sundar, we want to know everything about him. We want to understand all of his expansions, all of his energies, all of his variety, and his power. I was thinking about that sometimes when we're in front of the deities and we're thinking about the great merciful nature of Gaur-Nitai, and thinking about the great beauty of Radha Shyama Sundar and also of Krishna Balaram, we often don't think about, but at the same time that they are standing there manifesting their full beauty, they are creating unlimited universes. In other words, Krishna is carrying all of this on, you know, simultaneously. And as Prabhupada said in the purport, all of this creation goes on by his will, by his direction, by his intelligence, but yet he has nothing to do. That means he has nothing to do but enjoy. Nothing to do but play, enjoy with his devotees in Goloka Vrindavan. But through his energy, through his incarnations, through his manifestations, everything is going on. And that's what is important to learn about this. So just a real quick overview. I think it's been pretty clear here from the purports. First, Karnadakshai Vishnu lies down in the causal ocean. And Prabhupada made a nice point here. Causal means Karna. So this is the source, the cause of everything. You know, first expand, you know, there's different expansions. How does it go? Krishna, Balaram, then is it Pradyumna, Niruddha? So Karna Vishnu comes next after the four? After the Chaturvyuha?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vasudev, Sankarsana, Gautama, Niruddha.
And then
second quadruple.
Yeah, then Mahavishnu. And Mahavishnu. So, in other words, Mahavishnu is incredibly powerful as he is. And all the universes coming out of his pores. He's actually down the line of incarnations coming from Krishna. You know, he's hit a further expansion. But he activates the Mahatattva. He actually creates the Mahatattva and activates the Mahatattva into creating all the different globes, all the universes that are now floating out there. Then, of course, Garbhadakshai Vishnu, the next expansion, enters within each one of those universes, which are half filled with water. This is called the Garbhadak Ocean. And lies down there, and from his navel sprouts the lotus flower. And of course, from the lotus flower is Lord Brahma. And we all know the story, it will come up in the second canto, how Lord Brahma becomes enlightened, how he's instructed by Krishna, and is given the creative energy, the creative impulse to create the universe. Now, Lord Brahma, in a sense, doesn't really create the universe. He's described here, Prabhupada says, as an engineer. In other words, the engineer doesn't create, you know, if the engineer is building a building, he hasn't created the metal, the wood, everything else. He's assembling it, putting it together, maybe the contractor, whoever. Other people, they're assembling it. So Lord Brahma is taking all these ingredients, the mahatattva, the material energy, prakriti, and assembling them into the different bodies, into different forms, mountains, ocean, everything else that we see in the universe, in the different planetary systems, which is an incredible job in itself. I mean, it's amazing, Lord Brahma's power and his ability and his amazing service to Krishna. But he is not the final creator. That's the point. That is all coming from Vishnu, ultimately from Krishna. Then, of course, Shiradakshai Vishnu, the third expansion, comes about. Shiradakshai Vishnu is actually situated also on his own planet called Swetadvipa. And we hear from right in the beginning of the 10th canto, when there was great distress on the planet Earth, Bhumi, and goes to Lord Brahma, and they all go to the planet of Swetadeep, right? But they can't. They have to stand on the shore, right? And Vishnu is situated on this island, and they talk, but they talk to him, and so that's about the only pastimes we have of Shirdakshai Vishnu on Swetadeep when demigods go to approach him like that. But what we better know Shirdakshai Vishnu for is the super soul. Prabhupada says, this was interesting, Paramatma of every material object, organic or inorganic, not just that he enters into the heart of every living entity. What does it mean, inorganic? It means matter. It means, and Prabhupada described that the super soul, the Paramatma, enters into every atom and between every atom. And, of course, within the heart of every living entity. This is inconceivable. The power of Krishna to expand himself into quadruple gazillion forms or whatever. I don't know how big of a number you could, it's obviously billions and quadrillions, and how many different living entities, how many atoms are there in all the universes? It actually staggers imagination. It becomes a chinta, right? Inconceivable. That this ability of Krishna to do this. But yet, it all makes sense. It really does. So the super souls known as Paramatma or Vishvatma, the soul of the universe, Antarangi might be a little different, but, Krishna within the heart. So he enters into the heart of each soul, each atom. And I think that this is probably the Vishnu incarnation that we most relate to. It's hard to have a relationship with Garbhodakshai Vishnu and Mahavishnu, really, but we're experiencing Shirdakshai Vishnu, the Paramatma, all the time, right? Whether we know it or not, he's there. Because he guides all living entities in this material universe in a general way, and very specifically, he guides the devotees. Really nice verse, Bhagavad Gita, Ishvara Sarva Bhutanam Pideshair Dunatishtati Vahayan Sarva Bhutani Yantarutani Mayaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, Arjuna, and directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of material energy. So, Prabhupada explains that all living entities get direction from the super soul. How does a bird or an animal know what to do? How to find its food and everything. It's all been directed. And, of course, I find some of the most interesting examples, things like birds migrating. How do they know where to go? They follow the flock. Well, how does a person in the front of the flock know? What if it's the first year that they ever migrate? How do they know exactly where to go? Do birds have that kind of intelligence? Do they have GPS, that they know to go from Canada to... A lot of the geese, they come from Canada and they go anywhere from North Carolina and down, wherever they find a warm spot. They're being directed. And there's some amazing examples that could be given, which evolution does not explain, of how these things can happen in nature. But there's a really wonderful little book, I don't know if anyone's ever seen it, called Nature's IQ. It was put out by devotees in Hungary, I believe, and by some of their professorial types, and it gives all these examples of how basically evolution is impossible as a theory to explain behavior, even in the material world. There's an example of the golden Arctic plover. I don't know how I got off onto this, but anyway, it's an interesting example. Anyone heard about the golden Arctic plover? It lives in Alaska, and in the winter, winter's pretty cold in Alaska, it migrates. It migrates to Hawaii. That's a long way, thousands of miles, and it's a little bitty bird. And there's no islands, there's nowhere to stop between Alaska and Hawaii. It's like 2,000 miles of just water. Now, how do they do that? Well, what they do is before they go, they eat as much as they can. They double their weight. They're just fat, filled with much, and they have just enough fat and just enough energy to fly at 2,000 miles, so they're just about ready to drop. And they make it to Hawaii. How did that happen by evolutionary theory? In other words, you can say, well, it's survival of the fittest, the ones that made it, Well, how did the first one ever make it? How would he have known how to eat all that and how to get there? How would he even know there was Hawaii was out there? It's, in other words, it's obviously super soul guiding these things. And higher intelligence. So there's many, many examples like that that you really just cannot explain through natural selection and the different theories of evolution. So anyway, everyone has been guided by Super Soul. And for the devotees specifically, as we hear like from Bhagavad Gita 10:10, Dhammi Buddhi Yogam Tam, I give them the intelligence to come to me. Where is that intelligence coming from? Super Soul in the heart. Krishna is directing us, guiding us, showing us how to come back to him, guiding us to the Guru, showing us how that we can give up everything in the material world and come back to Krishna. How could we possibly do this? How could we have figured out Krishna consciousness, and, oh yes, this is the right philosophy, and of all the millions of philosophies out there, and you know, it could have been just blind luck, but I would say we were guided by the Supreme. Because it said, you know, by the mercy of Krishna, one is given Guru, and by the mercy of Guru, one is given Krishna. So Super Soul helps us, and once we become devotees, is constantly helping us. First giving us that initial intelligence, and then helping to clear us of those anartas, you know, to be able to become purified, to more and more serve Krishna. As we hear from, which we just heard last chapter, 1-17, Krishna, the personality of Godhead, the Paramatma, in everyone's heart, benefactor, faithful devotee, cleanses desires for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee who has developed the urge to hear his message. So as Shri Daksha Vishnu is in the heart of every living entity, so also, in a similar way, as Karna and Garbha Daksha Vishnus. This was in the purport to this verse, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur made just an interesting little statement here. I'm just going to read it. I don't even pretend to fully understand it, but I thought it was an interesting perspective on it. He says, Karna Daksha Vishnu is the inner soul of Prakriti. Because, you know, he gets everything moving. Garbha Daksha Vishnu is the inner soul of the collective jivas. Because he comes into each material universe and helps Brahma get everything going within the universe. And Shri Daksha Vishnu is the inner soul of each individual jiva. So that's one way of understanding it also. Now, the important point that Prabhupada makes, especially in the last half or so, or last third of the purport, is that at every stage of creation, the impulse, the direction, the intent, the intelligence is all coming from Krishna. None of this is happening by random chance. We may see the material energy manifesting through the Vishnu incarnations. Then, of course, it all gets wrapped up, goes back into the body of Mahavishnu for, what, another lifetime of Brahma, or how much time it is, we don't know, trillions of years, then it all becomes manifested again. And, of course, each universe, there's the, you know, there's the, what do they call the annihilation, the more minor, you know, every day there's an annihilation, actually. And so these things are going on, things going back into Mahavishnu, into Garbhadaksha, being expanded again. But Bhagavatam 3:10-13 says, this cosmic manifestation is as it is now, it was the same in the past, and it will continue the same way in the future. So this is an eternal process that it goes over incredible time spans that we can't even imagine. You know, but the Prabhupada said there is a systematic schedule for the perpetual manifestation, maintenance, and annihilation of the material world. As it is created now and destroyed later on, so also it existed in the past and again will be created, maintained, and destroyed in due course. And one more, Bhagavad Gita 9:8 says, the whole cosmic order is under me. Under me, it is automatically manifested again and again, and under my will, it is annihilated at the end. So, manifestation, unmanifestation, it's all coming from Krishna. This material nature, Srila Prabhupada makes the point, has no creative power in itself. The Prakriti must have the presence of the Purusha. And Prabhupada gives the example of man and a woman. The woman by herself, although she gives birth to the child, cannot do it without, obviously, the seed of the father. So in the same way, the material energy without the seed of the Purusha, without the input of Krishna, the impetus, you know, cannot really manifest anything. So that intelligent, creative impetus must be there to activate matter. Now, Prabhupada gives a little dig, I guess you could say, or a little criticism of the materialists in science who deny this, who think that this is all. He says, we should not foolishly accept the atheistic theory of creation, the description of the atheists given by Bhagavad Gita. In other words, they do not believe there's a creator, but he cannot give a good theory to explain the creation. This is actually a fact. It really is. Materialists tend to think that religious views of creation and mythology. In other words, they even talk about, you've heard of creation myths? Every religion has, they say, a creation myth. Look at the Native Americans or this one or that one. The creation myth is something that they made up to explain how the world came about. I mean, that is their, not only their foolishness, but their conceit, their arrogance. In other words, to dismiss, like basically all world religions, things that 98% of the population on Earth have believed for millions, thousands and millions of years, is all mythology. You know. So we can see, what do they have to offer? What do they have to offer? Prabhupada says they can't explain. Well, they have some theories. Example, about their example of the creation, destruction of the universe. What's the most common theory of the creation of the universe? The Big Bang, right? The Big Bang. Now here is now this wasn't a parody, believe it or not. This is an actual explanation of the Big Bang theory. 10 billion to 20 billion years ago, a massive blast allowed all the universe's known matter and energy, even space and time themselves, to spring from some ancient and unknown type of energy. The theory maintains that in an instant, 1 trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, the universe expanded with incomprehensible speed from a pebble-sized origin to its astronomical scope. Are you all convinced? Do you believe that? I got a bridge to sell you to. Which is more plausible? The Big Bang theory, or that there's an intelligent designer behind all of this? Pretty obvious. I mean, even look in their own words. Unknown energy, incomprehensible speed. In other words, we don't really know. We're wildly speculating that maybe this happened. So, anyway, they've come up with other theories. I think I mentioned these before, but I always think they're fun. Some of the countering theories to the Big Bang now is they got the Big Freeze, where the universe expands until it becomes so cold till it's frozen. The Big Rip, where it continually expands until it disintegrates. The Big Crunch, that all comes back into itself. Well, it kind of does. That one may be true. And the Big Bounce, that it comes back and recreates itself over and over. So, we could make up as many theories as we want, but yet we have, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we have actual, real information. We have Krishna telling us how it came about. We have Shukadeva Suta Goswamis. We have the great Vaishnava devotees giving their, not just their opinion, but their self-realized understanding, the depth of knowledge of how Krishna is creating all of this. I mean, sometimes when I read Srila Prabhupada's purports, you know, because he talks about everything, right? Everything's here in the Bhagavatam, and he'll explain the concept of creation, he'll explain time, he'll explain. I'm thinking, how can Prabhupada know all these different, you know? I mean, you know, when you think about it, you'd have to study each one of these sort of subtopics of philosophy. And, you know, we know that, yeah, I mean, Prabhupada did read the other acharyas' purports, something like that, but he basically just dictated purports, right? He wasn't, like, studying for hours and hours and hours, I don't think, on each purport. Many of them, you know, he just spoke. How? Because he, as he once said, it is not him speaking, but Krishna. That Krishna is dictating. So the self-realized soul can understand all of these complex things, you know, and it's not a matter of material intelligence. It's a matter of realization, a matter of Krishna inspiring one from within. So while some of this more intricate technical knowledge certainly seems difficult to most of us, you know, we will understand it more and more. And I think most devotees, we understand the gist of it, you know. Even if you couldn't recite all the technicalities of how everything came about and how all the senses were created and the elements, right? You know, I mean, that gets really technical, like in the third canto and all of that. But we have the main idea, which is everything is coming from Krishna. Krishna is the source of everything. If you really have that and you believe that, then everything else is like just is more knowledge, fills that out. It's good to know, but we know the basis. And it's interesting because we're talking about Lord Brahma, and Lord Brahma being born from the lotus of the enlightened, and actually Lord Brahma gave us some wonderful information about this. And of course, his most famous thing that he's, besides the, well, he didn't speak the Chatur Shlokas, Krishna spoken to Lord Brahma, but probably the most well-known thing that Lord Brahma himself spoke was Brahma Samhita, right? So Brahma Samhita was spoken by Lord Krishna after his enlightenment, and Krishna revealed everything to him. It's all about the Loka Vrindavan, his abode, his nature, his body, intimate look at the spiritual world. I read this, I found this out, there was originally 100 chapters of the Brahma Samhita. It was a huge book, but I don't think we have it at all. Lord Chaitanya discovered the fifth chapter. So the Brahma Samhita, is where Lord Chaitanya gave it to us. I don't think it wasn't, no one could find it. No one knew where it was until Lord Chaitanya found it. So we have that very, very incredibly wonderful fifth chapter, and of course, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura translated in a commentary, and that's, we have that version of it. And the very where I'm getting with this is the very beginning, before all the verses explaining Goloka Vrindavan and Chintamani and all of that, we have Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadiradir Govinda Sarva Karana Karana. So in other words, before we talk about Goloka Vrindavan and the gopis and anything else, let's make sure you understand who Krishna is. Who is it we're talking about? Krishna is known as Govinda. Is the Supreme Godhead, Ishvara Parama Krishna. He has an eternal, blissful spiritual body, Satchidananda Vigraha. Anadiradir Govinda, he is the origin of all. And Sarva Karana Karanam, he is the prime cause of all causes. He has no other origin, he's the origin of all, and he is the cause of all causes, which is what we're talking about. So, and we get confirmed again and again this very important message. Krishna is not just a form of God or an incarnation or a demigod, but it's clearly stated the origin of all, the cause of all causes. He has an eternal, blissful body filled with knowledge. And he's not impersonal. Vigraha is a spiritual form. So, just focus just a minute on the Sarva Karana Karanam, which is our topic today. He's the final cause of everything. He personally expands his energy in the spiritual world and in the material world. He regulates and controls the material nature by his Vishnu expansions, as we're talking about. So when we talk about causation, we say that Krishna is the ingredient cause and the efficient cause. Now the efficient cause, actually, as explained by Aristotle, was the primary source of the change or rest. That is the artisan, in the case of a statue, or the father of a child. In other words, who is behind it? The ingredient causes, are those things supplied by material energy. But the material energy itself is coming from Krishna. So everything is dependent upon the final causation of Krishna. As the verse describes Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila 6:16, Apane Purusha Vishvara Nimita Karana Advaita Rupe Apatana Ana Narayana. Lord Vishnu himself is the efficient cause, which is called Nimita, of the material world, and Narayan is the form of, in the form of Sri Advaita, who is also Mahavishnu, is the material cause, Upadana. So we have this Upadana and Nimita, and they're terms that I use a little bit differently, but they're the same idea as the remote cause and immediate cause. So Prabhupada says, I think it's in that purport. No, I'm sorry. This is in the 431.17 purport. Krishna is the remote cause. Material nature is the immediate cause of cosmic manifestation. Material nature is the immediate cause, but the original cause is Narayan Krishna. Sometimes people think the cause of an earthen pot is the earth. We see on a potter's wheel a sufficient amount of earth to produce many pots. And although an unintelligent man would say the earth on the wheel is the cause of the pot, those who are actually advanced will find the original cause is the potter, who supplies the earth and moves the wheel. Okay? So in other words, the ingredients are supplied and the energy to to actually create the pot is supplied there by the potter, in the same way Krishna does. Material nature may be a helping factor in the creation of this cosmic manifestation, but not the ultimate cause. So we have this idea of the nimitta karana, nupadana, upadana karana. And we also have another concept from philosophy called the final cause. At least in Greek philosophy, it's called telos. And it means the purpose, the end or the goal of something. And in the philosophy is called teleology, which means, I'm reading from the Wikipedia Purana, a philosophical account which holds the final causes exist in nature, meaning there's design and purpose. So we want to see behind material nature, what is the cause and purpose? And that's what we get from the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam tells us what is the final cause, what is the immediate cause. 431.18 Bhagavatam says, because the Supreme Lord is the cause of all causes, he is the super soul of all individual living entities, and he exists as both the remote and immediate cause. Okay, we got it, right? Krishna is behind everything, final cause, the remote cause. So how is this relevant? Many ways it's relevant. We've talked about a little bit, understanding Krishna, understanding somebody we love. We want to know everything about them. I was thinking about that idea a little bit. Let's say a husband and wife, somebody you care about very much. You know, and they tell you about their childhood and what happened to them and all of these different things. And, you know, you find it interesting and you listen to that. And you want to know all these different sort of details about them. Now, if a stranger came up to you and started telling you all this detail of everything that happened in life and what they played with when they grew up, you go, okay, yeah, right. I mean, we wouldn't care so much. We care about the details because of affection, because it's somebody we care about, someone we love. So in the same way, because we love Krishna and have affection from everything about him is lovable. Everything is something that we value. At any rate, so understanding that God is the final cause, how does this help us? Well, we know that Krishna is behind everything, and there's a purpose behind it. Nothing is happening by accident. Nothing is happening haphazardly, remotely, simply by, some unknown circumstance, by luck, No, everything has a purpose. In the Bhagavatam 10.4.27, Vasudeva says to Kamsa, persons with a vision of differentiation, now what he's talking about is understanding that Krishna is different, that the material energy is different than Krishna, not part of it. Persons with a vision of differentiation are imbued with material qualities, lamentation, jubilation, fear, envy, greed, illusion, and madness. They are influenced by the immediate cause, which they are busy counteracting, but they have no knowledge of the remote or supreme cause, the personality of Godhead. So in other words, if we're focusing on the intermediate causes, the differentiation, and not then we're subject to all of these things, lamentation, illusion, envy, fear, madness. In other words, material energy, Maya. We're being affected by Maya if that's what we are thinking that it's all about, that this is what causes the world, this is what is making everything happening, and don't have knowledge of Krishna. Prabhupada said, Krishna is the cause of all causes, sarva karana karanam, but one who has no connection with Krishna is disturbed by immediate causes, and cannot restrain his vision of separateness or difference. In other words, yes, we know Chindaveda Veda Tattva, Krishna is not exactly the same, but it's all coming from him. We don't see anything that's separate from him or not being part of Krishna. When an expert physician treats a patient, he tries to find the original cause of the disease and is not diverted by the symptoms of that original cause. Similarly, a devotee is never disturbed by reverses in life. A devotee understands that when he is in distress, this is due to his own past misdeeds, which are now accruing in reaction. Oh, by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they are only slight. Karmani nirdhati kintu chabakti pajam. Anybody know where that's from?
Brahmasumita.
I never get you. You're right. Yes, Brahmasumita 554. Not exactly the most common verse that most of us know, but it's a very interesting verse that Lord Brahma spoke. He says, I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who burns up to their roots all fruitive activities of those who are imbued with devotion, and impartially ordains for each the due enjoyment of the fruits of one's activities. Of all those who walk in the path of work, in accordance with the chain of their previously performed works, no less than the case of a tiny insect that bears the name Indragopa than that of Indra, the king of the Devas. In other words, everybody gets their reaction, but for the devotee, one who's imbued with devotion, it says that they are actually burning up all of those fruit of activities. There's people that turn their cell phones off during class. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj says, God impartially induces the fallen souls to act in a way that is consequent on the deeds of their previous births and to enjoy the fruition of their labors. But out of his great mercy to his devotees, he purges out by the fire of ordeal the root of all karma, nescience, and evil desires. Karma, though without beginning, is still perishable. Those who are pure devotees always serve Krishna by gratifying his senses, forsaking all attempts of karma and jnana, and being free from all desires save that of serving Krishna. Krishna has fully destroyed the karma, its desires, and nescience of those devotees. It is a great wonder that Krishna, being impartial, is fully partial to his devotees. Okay. End at that point. Thank you all very much. No voices should grow up on. Yes, look, Columbia Ganesh. We have a microphone.
Thank you for a very nice class, Prabhu. It was mentioned that Shirdakshayi Vishnu, Super Soul Paramatma, enters into every atom, into the heart of every living entity as the presiding source of intelligence. He says, of all the senses, I am the mind, and therefore we understand the mind comprises of three activities, thinking, feeling, and willing. And therefore, he is the one who's doing these activities, and we're simply accepting or rejecting those thoughts, feelings, and willings. Only by Krishna consciousness can we actually be willing to accept favorable things for advancing spiritually. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, our senses are simply rejecting any suggestions in that respect simply for our own personal aggrandizement or advancement, physical advancement. Trying to understand how we can perceive what is in our better objective, what is our better, superior objective. It's difficult to understand how mm-hmm. something transcendental is going to benefit us when we're in a precarious position practically.
Right. Well, of course, that's what knowledge is. That's what intelligence is to understand it. To understand the precarious position of the material world, as you said, and our position in that, and higher knowledge given to us by Guru in scriptures helps us to understand why we need to make those choices. But your point was very good that, you know, so much is about our desire and how the senses and the mind are affected by those desires. And sometimes it's said that the free will the living entity actually has is about desire, right? It's our free will is we can desire Krishna, or we can desire Maya. it's kind of like once we've made that choice, if what we want is material enjoyment, then the senses, the mind, intelligence are directed on how to achieve that, right? In other words, the senses want something, the mind's thinking yes, yes, accepting, rejecting, but these, and then the intelligence says, okay, this is, I'm going to get that, right? So, you know, but in the same process is there. Conversely, for the devotee, if somebody, that Krishna gives the intelligence of how to achieve spiritual aims. I think the difficult thing sometimes for devotees, I don't know if you're exactly saying this, but I was thinking it when you said it, is what I am desiring, is it coming from my senses and mind, or is this really from Krishna? In other words, am I being given direction, intelligence by Krishna here, or is it just my mind's desire and I'm listening to that? And I think we all struggle with that, don't we, to some degree? I mean, that's what we always have. And then we always have to, that's where the philosophy is so important. And of course, our chanting and the purification process of sadhana bhakti. Because the more our mind is purified, more intelligence is purified, then the more we will be listening, you know, right, to super soul and to the scriptures and to the guru, you know, sadhu shastra, you know, guru sadhu shastra and all that, and not listening to the mind. And that's just, and it's really a question of process of Krishna consciousness. Let's go over to the here. Sukhita.
I always like this analogy of the Big Bang Theory. That was great. It said it's like there's an explosion in a printing press, and from that explosion comes a dictionary, you know? Everything just all lined up.
Yeah.
So it's so preposterous. It's amazing people believe it.
It's kind of like that, yeah, an explosion print. And sometimes they say if you, you know, if a monkey was banging on a keyboard long enough for enough years, he'd eventually, you know, do the Encyclopedia Britannica. But it's never going to happen. I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, right, it could eventually. There's some, what are the chances, you know? You know, you remember I haven't read it for a long time, but Sataputta Prabhu's little book on, which one was it, Mechanistic Science or some of those that he wrote. And one of them, I forget which one, he calculated what the chances were of just like one amino acid by chance coming together, just the atoms coming together to form one amino acid or something, or one protein. And it was something like, you know, okay, you got about one in, you know, trillions and trillions chance of that even happening. What to speak of, all this, you know, that then becomes a human being. You know, I mean, just like one cell. These things, yeah, okay, theoretically it could happen, but really, come on. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I've always been critical of the evolutionary theory. But many scientists says that the theory has been existing for hundreds of years, And no one, no creationist has been able to falsify it. Usually when they have like theories and stuff, they would put it aside if it's been falsified. But they said that no one is able to falsify the evolutionary theory.
No one is able to contradict it or find fault with it, you're saying?
Falsified it means that you have to show that it's not correct.
You're saying no one has done that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, many scientists...
Well, that's not true at all, of course.
You know?
They say that, but that's not true. I mean, you know, in fact, there are many parts of the evolutionary theory that most scientists reject. Even ones who say, yeah, we think maybe it's sort of true, but they say the way that Darwin actually presented it, they say this doesn't really work, that doesn't work, and there isn't proof of that. There's no... Yeah, it's not that well. It's not that it's widely accepted by everybody. In fact, there are hundreds and hundreds of scientists who have rejected evolutionary theory. I have some statistics on it. I worked up one class, and they want to present it that, well, this is the absolute truth. Everybody knows it, you know, and it's just a few fanatics, a few fringe, you know, religious people, you know, who don't accept it. It's actually not true. It's not a very sound theory. And, you know, if you read some of, like Judah Karma's, you know, works where he has just all kinds of, you know, not from just religion, but all kinds of scientific information to refute it. I think it's on very shaky ground. You know, and in fact, many, many people, I mean, the thing of creationism and evolution always looked like it was kind of from the fundamental right-wing Christians, so it didn't really have a... But now they kind of repackaged it and they call it intelligent design. You know, no, really, seriously, many, many people accept much easier the idea of intelligent design, which is, you know, was there an intelligent force that wouldn't be behind everything? Even if it went through some evolutionary-like process, didn't it have to have some higher spiritual intelligence behind it? And many people believe that. You know, it's... I think it's, you know, it's like you get the hardcore scientist trying to convince you that, of course, any intelligent person believes this. It's just not true. Frank Govinda?
Okay. I was thinking, like, we are not talking about the same thing.
Because we are discussing conscious evolution. They are not talking about conscious evolution. No. They're talking about mutation, selection. This has really nothing to do with soul at all, conscious being.
No. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you're talking about an entirely different thing. Obviously, we do believe in evolution, but spiritual evolution. Because, you know, people do evolve from one body to another to higher bodily forms, you know, through the different species, you know, which is the evolution of the soul, which is very, very different. You're right. Yes?
We know that Prabhupada said that there's no such thing as instinct.
I don't know if he said that. Go ahead.
Oh, is that true?
I have a quote we talked about. We defined it. But go ahead. Say what you're going to say.
I'm wondering how Webster defines instinct, if in fact it's not really...
Yeah, no. Okay, no such thing as instinct the way the scientists say, that it just is in somehow, you know, mysterious process, like instinct would be like, you know, the ducks migrating south. Prabhupada said what it is... I remember the quote though. Prabhupada said, instinct is a combination of learned behavior and super soul guiding.
Okay.
Well, so if you add super soul, then we can accept instinct.
I see.
Yeah.
But therefore I wonder what the materialists, how they define the word instinct.
Oh, they have all kinds of things, like it's part of the genetic code, you know, that's passed on. Somehow in your genes, you knew to dig a hole or migrate or whatever the animal does. No, they have their theories, but they're not very convincing. They're about as convincing as the Big Bang, I think. Okay, one more, then one.
I was remembering a pastime where I forgot most of the details. The sons of the Brahmin were taken away, and Krishna and Arjuna went to see. Who was it that they went to see?
Mahavishnu. Oh, the other one. Yeah.
So they went to see Mahavishnu, and he said that to Krishna, you are my incarnation. So it's always kind of like unusual, because we generally think Krishna, he expanded himself, and Mahavishnu is downline, so to speak.
You know, this is a confusing point, because just as we're reading that Shiradakshaya Vishnu is the source of all the incarnations, all the Leela avatars, so if you see Krishna as just another Leela avatar, when he comes, then actually, in other words, it's kind of true that Vishnu is the source of all the incarnations, but Krishna is actually the source of Mahavishnu at the same time. Prangaminda, do you have a comment on that particular thing?
Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives this
explanation that actually Arjuna was not so close to Krishna at that time. This is a battlefield took place after 50 years from that incident. Hmm. So Krishna wanted Arjuna to become very close friend. So Jogamaya creating this scenery. When Mahavishnu expressed this, that you are my expansion, the conclusion was, at the end Arjuna realized that it is Krishna who made Mahavishnu to speak like this, just to bewilder Arjuna. Because on the way back, Arjuna started thinking about it. Who is this person who has more interest for my well-wisher, well-being than I could do on my own? I could not even save myself. I could not even keep my fame, Gandiva and all this. And he went one by one, that how come any shopper can see Krishna? Even any small Brahmana can see Krishna in Dwarka and Mahavishnu could not come see Krishna because it is Krishna who controls everything. Even Mahavishnu could not come to Dwarka to see him. So when he went through the whole cycle of back and forth, cause and effect, then he fell at the feet of Krishna. Yeah. And then they became very bonded, like a best friend.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. I think that explains it. Helps. Okay. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada.